From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Poet Langston Hughes wanted to be the first Afro-American to make a living as a writer, and he succeeded. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet his biographer, Arnold Rampersad. Also today, we speak with Kevin Boyle, executive director of Article 19, a new organization fighting all forms of censorship worldwide. Performer-in-residence Harry Connick Jr. is back, this time playing a couple of Harold Arlen songs. And critic Ken Tucker cuts past all the hype to see how the movie E.T. holds up on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? That's from one of Langston Hughes's most quoted poems, Harlem. Langston Hughes is generally acknowledged as the most prominent and most popular Afro-American poet of the century. Hughes championed racial consciousness as a source of inspiration for black artists, and many black writers have credited him with changing their self-images as blacks. My guest is Langston Hughes's biographer, Arnold Rampersad. He spent 9 years researching Hughes's life and examining the racial and political issues that inspired his poems. A New York Times book review called the biography superlative. A Los Angeles Times review called it a literary event. Rampersad is professor of English at Columbia University and the author of The Art and Imagination of W.E.B. Du Bois. The newly published second volume of his biography, The Life of Langston Hughes, covers the years from 1941 through 1967 when Hughes died at the age of 65. Let's start things off with a recording of Hughes reading his poem Weary Blues, which is inspired by a blues song he heard as a child. The poem was written in the early 1920s. This recording is from 1958 and features jazz accompaniment by a septet led by trumpeter Red Allen.
Groan in a drowsy, syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of a one-bulb light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, 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 went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
That's Langston Hughes, and my guest is Arnold Rampersad, his biographer. Arnold Rampersad, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You described the poem that we just heard as one of Langston Hughes' first important poems and one of the first poems that linked blues and formal poetry.
Yes, Carl Sandburg before Hughes had done something with jazz, just very briefly in, I think, Jazz Fantasies, I believe it's called. But Hughes was the first poet to, in America, in the world, really, to look seriously at black music, at jazz, at the blues, at ragtime even, and to try to fuse that poetry with, or that music, that art, with formal poetry. And that's one of his very first poems. There he encloses the blues in a formal poem later on by the end of the decade. That was written in 1923, I think. By the end of the decade, he was writing blues by themselves, as it were, just simply bowing to the musicians who had created this wonderful art form out of Afro-American experience.
Why did he write so many poems in a blues style or in dialect?
Well, in the blues style, I think he believed blues was more than just a musical style. He believed that the spirit of the blues was, if there was such a thing as one spirit of black Americans, that the blues best represented the spirit of black Americans. In other words, it was based in a sense of adversity, in a sense of suffering and tragedy, but it was converted through laughter and through the art of music. It was converted into something that was positive. It was emotion, in other words, from oppression to a kind of victory, always with laughter somewhere in the vicinity. And he thought that that amounted almost to a philosophy, if you like, of black life, and also a philosophy that that other peoples could turn to as they dealt with experience.
But his blues-inspired poems were criticized by both black and white critics. What kinds of criticisms did he get for these poems?
Well, his second book of poems, Fine Clothes to the Jew, which is very heavily a blues collection, I mean, that was absolutely savaged by the black critics. I think that they resented the fact that Hughes, in using dialect and in talking about people fighting with one another or prostitution and so on, urban malaise, despair, whatever, that he was showing the bad side of the race to white people. But more informed critics, both black and white, recognized that something really significant was being done. An important Chicago critic, later a major professor of American studies, Howard Mumford Jones, pointed out that in using the blues, Hughes really was doing an extraordinary thing. He was adding a form to English poetry, like the sonnet or the ballad form. And I think that's absolutely true. And a number of poets since the 20s down to our day, both black and white, have continued to write blues poetry.
Langston Hughes wanted to make his living as a writer. Was he the first black American writer to be able to accomplish that?
Over a long period of time, absolutely, yes. Paul Laurence Dunbar, at the turn of the century, had enjoyed a national vogue, and he did very well for a few years. But Langston believed from the time he was 19, 20, certainly by the time he was 23 or 24, that he was going to be a writer and that he would exist simply by his writing. He lived until 1967. He held two temporary jobs, teaching in the Chicago Lab School at one point and also at Atlanta University at another point, 3 months each. Otherwise, he simply lived by his writing. So that meant that he starved a great deal of the time, but he stuck to his path.
My guest is Arnold Rampersand, who's written a two-volume biography of Langston Hughes. The second volume has just been published. I'd like to ask you to read Hughes' very first published poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers.
This poem was published in 1921 in The Crisis, edited by W.B. Du Bois. The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like rivers.
Is that a poem that you especially like?
I do. I like it a great deal. It comes out of a particular moment in Hughes's life. He was going off to Mexico to join his father. His father hated the idea that his son wanted to become a poet. His father, who was black, did not like black Americans, didn't like white Americans because of the way they treated him, wanted Langston Hughes to exile himself and go after money. Hughes said that he was crossing the Mississippi in a train on the way to Mexico. He looked at the sunset, the river, and it came to him suddenly that he was a part of a noble people, no matter how much they had been oppressed, what degree of poverty so many of them existed in. And this phrase came to him: "I've known rivers. We are historical. We have depth. We have spirituality." And the poem wrote itself, according to him. We don't know if it's true, but all the evidence shows that in fact it came out of that particular moment. And it's very interesting that a poem written at 19 years of age, just about, remained, in a way, his benchmark poem. I mean, I'm sure he was being asked to read it in the very last year of his life.
You got at something that's a real paradox of Langston Hughes' early life. You mentioned that his father really disliked American blacks, and Langston Hughes really disliked his father for that.
Yes.
He didn't see his father very much when he was growing up.
No, he did not.
But also when Langston Hughes was growing up, he wasn't always exposed to that many blacks. In his high school, he was one of few blacks.
That's true. In his high school, in the school before that, where he wrote his first poem in the little town of Lincoln in Illinois, and before that in Lawrence, Kansas, where he grew up. He was very often the only, or perhaps one of two or three blacks.
Yet he wrote so many poems celebrating the black experience. Do you think that being not among that many blacks during part of his childhood made him more aware of his blackness?
Absolutely, I think. Mm-hmm. I think he was exposed to black culture, say, in the churches, and in one or two people who were very kind to him. And I think he early on identified the regard, the loving regard of black people, as something that meant a tremendous amount to him. I don't think anything meant more to him than that. But you're right. I mean, he going on to Columbia University, he certainly did not meet any large number of blacks there. And I think he was empowered by that, the fact that he was viewing the culture to some extent inside, to a large extent from outside, made him really devoted to it.
It was in Harlem that he felt he really found his home. What brought him there?
Well, his father wanted him to go to Switzerland and study three languages and learn mining because his father owned mines in Mexico. Langston told the father he could do the same thing at Columbia, but he really wanted to go to Harlem because in 1921, Shuffle Along, with a musical, historic musical, had just opened. People were beginning to sense that the phenomenon known as the Harlem Renaissance was on its way. Exciting things were happening in that part of the world, and he wanted to be a part of that, where the Crisis magazine, Du Bois was, James Weldon Johnson, Jesse Fawcett, any number of people were there, young Paul Robeson later on. He wanted to be a part of that, so he went off to Harlem and fell in love with it. I mean, he wandered around the world a great deal, but 1947, when he finally got a little bit of money from a musical play, he bought a house and stayed there for the next 20 years of his life.
Would you read us one of his poems about Harlem?
This is a little poem from the 20s. It's called "Aesthete in Harlem." Strange that in this nigger place I should meet life face to face, when for years I had been seeking life in places gentler speaking, until I came to this vile street and found life stepping on my feet.
When you read one of Hughes's poems out loud, do you feel influenced at all by his own style of reading?
Well, I don't know how well he read his own poetry, and he did not have a great deal of force, and he also did not like poems, he said, read in a far-off manner, kind of stagey manner, and I think maybe I like a little bit of staginess in the reading of poetry. I like the way he reads his poems because what comes through is his humility about the poetic medium. He doesn't pretend there is more in his poem than he thinks there is. But I like hearing, say, Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee read his poetry. They're wonderful at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your work on the life of Langston Hughes, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Arnold Rampersand. He's a professor of English at Columbia University and the author of a 2-volume biography of Langston Hughes. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Talking about the life and poems of Langston Hughes, my guest is his biographer, Arnold Rampersad. You know, you were saying that you found Hughes's own readings lacking in a certain drama. I really like the way he reads with jazz musicians, and I think it, in a way, foreshadows some of the beat poets and the way they read their own work.
I think he was very proud of that. Carl Sandburg, of course, jumped in the 50s and said, "Oh, I was doing that a long time ago," but really, it is Langston Hughes who first made a great thing out of reading poetry to a jazz accompaniment. He saw jazz as the authentic 20th century American music, and his poetry just seemed to go naturally along with it. And I think yes, he reads much better when he has that jazz accompaniment.
Let's play another example of him reading one of his poems with a jazz accompaniment. This is recorded in 1958. The poem is Note on Commercial Theater, and playing with him is Red Allen on trumpet, Vic Dickinson on trombone, Sam Taylor on tenor sax, Al Williams at the piano, Milt Hinton on bass, and O.C. Johnson drums.
You've taken my blues and gone. You sing them on Broadway, and you sing them in Hollywood Bowl. You mixed them up with symphonies, and you fixed them so they don't sound like me. Yep, you've done taken my blues and gone. You also took my spirituals and gone. You put me in Macbeth, and Carmen Jones, and all kind of swing Mikados, and in everything but what's about me. But someday somebody'll stand up and talk about me and write about me, black and beautiful, and sing about me and put on plays about me. I reckon it'll be me myself. Yes, it'll be me.
When Langston Hughes is saying, "You've taken my blues and gone," is he meaning literally himself or the work of blacks in general? And I ask that knowing that he worked on the commercial theater and wasn't usually all that satisfied with the results.
No, he wasn't really talking about himself so much as the way in which so many aspects of American entertainment have taken parts of black culture, left the blacks behind if they could. I'm talking now historically. Converted jazz into sort of a hybrid musical form that would appeal across the board to people who themselves would not really want to have anything to do with the originators of the music, the black musicians. He's talking about that, and he's hoping that one day blacks will be able to speak with their own true voices, that blacks will write their own literature and not simply have to read about themselves refracted through the eyes of white authors or white musicians. That poem was written in the 1940s, and perhaps the time has come.
There was an interesting tension in his work between his desire for commercial success and his interest in radical politics, and he found the two finally unreconcilable.
Yes, he did. In the 30s, I think you noticed that tension most of all, because, say, at the Karamu Playhouse in Cleveland, he is trying out plays which he, I think, hoped hoped would come to Broadway. At the same time, he really is in his most radical phase, 32, 33, 34. In 1938, the Harlem Suitcase Theater puts on essentially a radical play of his, Don't You Want to Be Free? Yet still, he's getting older, and he wants to make some money. He wants to have a house, finally. In his lifetime, he wants to have a house.
And, but he wants people to read his poems, and what he was finding was the people who he wanted as his audience really weren't interested in the kind of Marxist-oriented
poetry. That is absolutely
true.
I would say that the masses of black Americans, he wanted to reach them, he wanted to stay with them, and they were definitely not interested in radical socialist poetry. That certainly is true.
I was very interested in your chronicling of his reactions to the black literature of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and the reactions of black poets and novelists to Langston Hughes's work as Hughes got older.
Yes.
For instance, he didn't like Native Son. He thought the story was too sordid and that
right.
Blacks needed heroes.
Yes. He felt it was the wrong time. In 1940, World War II had started, if not for the United States, for the rest of the world. But I think any time he would have found the realism, the ultra-realism of Native Son, just the depiction of its black hero as essentially a brute, that was just too much for Langston Hughes, who believed that the beauty of the people should also be pointed out. And that book, I think, does not give two sides. I respect the book profoundly, but he's right in that the book does not even suggest a possibility of a richer, more humane side to black culture. And he found the same fault with a number of later books by black writers.
In the 1960s, when there were more radical definitions of blackness and when a lot of black writers were becoming more militant in their writing, many of them really parted with Langston Hughes. He didn't necessarily like their work, and they didn't necessarily respect his accomplishments. Let me quote something that you quote, that Amiri Baraka, who is still going by the name of Leroy Jones, said in 1965. He said, "Let Langston and his ilk keep silent in the face of real artists. Theater in 1965 is not for leftover Lazaruses of the so-called Negro Renaissance."
Well, that's particularly interesting, since in the 50s, when Leroy Jones was living in the Village and Greenwich Village, and performing as an editor, sometimes as the only black, usually as the only black in a sea of white poetic voices, Langston often pressed him to take race more into account. I mean, he liked and admired Leroy Jones. He thought he was enormously talented, but he kept telling him, you have got to look at your own people and what we have done and listen to the blues and the jazz and so on. 5 years later, 6 or 7 years later, Leroy Jones has swept past Langston Hughes, but of course, we know that he has also returned in recent years back to a position much closer to Langston Hughes than he was in 1965 or 66. And he now speaks with great reverence for Langston Hughes, if only because he discovered later on that many of the positions he took subsequent to that nationalist episode were positions anticipated by Langston Hughes maybe 30 years ago. So he is among the most fervent praisers of Langston Hughes today.
You raise the question of Langston Hughes' sexuality in your book. Some people thought he was homosexual, in part because he never married and also because he frequently hung around with young, attractive men. But you suggest he was probably asexual and that there's really no evidence that he partook of many heterosexual relationships or any homosexual relationships.
Right. I encountered the rumors fairly early on, and also the beliefs that this man was homosexual. I think the sexuality of a poet, of a writer, is very important for a biographer.
Why? Because some people would think, well, that's really none of the public's business. Why are you bringing that up?
Well, I think that biography is the story of the life, and sexuality is obviously important to the life. It may not be so important to the art, and I think it's not very easy to tell from Langston Hughes's poetry his sexual persuasion. But I think the biographer really is interested in every aspect, even those that's important, even if it's not related to the art. If, for example, Langston Hughes had run for office and for some particular office that had nothing to do with poetry, it would still be important important to a biographer. I tracked down this aspect of his life as best I could, as diligently as I could. I was certainly prepared to reveal anything I found that would be definitive or persuasive. Found nothing. The true story is that the man seemed to hide his sexual activity to such an extent that you have to wonder how much of it there was and why he was so determined not to let people know what he was doing in this regard. He created a family for himself toward the end of his life, but it was a family in which he, as a 40-something, 50-something, and then 60-something-year-old man, was essentially a son, because he was living with a man and woman he called aunt and uncle, who were not really related to him, but who had known him virtually all his life. So he believed in family life, that's for sure. He believed in young people. He clearly, in the 50s and 60s, saw some young men as his sons and tried to help them. But as far as I know, that was the extent to which it went.
Let me ask you to read one more Langston Hughes poem. Would you read Dream Variation?
Dream Variation is a poem that written again in his youth, about 1924, I would think. Dream Variation. To fling my arms wide in some place of the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree, while night comes on gently, dark like me. That is my dream. To fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, dance, whirl, whirl, till the quick day is done, rest at pale evening, a tall, slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me.
When Langston Hughes died at the age of 65 in 1967, do you think that he felt that his writing had been appreciated?
I think he did. The previous year he had been to, I always forget the exact name of this gathering, but it was a gathering of Pan-African peoples, artists of the world in Dakar, put on by Leopold Sédar Senghor, the poet president of Senegal. And you had people from all over the world, blacks and whites, and he clearly was regarded as one of the founding fathers of the idea of negritude, or of soul, if you like, in a literary and artistic sense. The New York Times talked about how young writers followed him about the way in the United States youngsters would follow a baseball star about. So he knew he had left his mark on world culture, particularly where black people were concerned. Whether he felt he'd got exactly his justice, I don't know, but he was to some extent a fatalistic person. So I'm pretty certain that he believed at the end that he had done well. He had done well, that he had lived up to the charge that his grandmother must have left him, and that was that he had to do something for the world, something that was noble, something that was good, worthwhile for the world. And he had done so.
You only have a few seconds left, but let me ask you, you must have asked yourself what Langston Hughes would have thought of your two-volume biography had he been able to read it?
I think he would have chuckled. I think he would have laughed. At his funeral, he requested that, in planning for it, requested that the last tune be a tune that Duke Ellington made famous called Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. And I think he would have believed that somehow he had reached across from the grave. He had an offbeat sense of humor, and he would have been amused at some of the mistakes in the book, too, because, of course, there must be mistakes, since no biographer can possibly recover the truth either about the facts or even the spirit of the person, not 100% truth. So somewhere I think he is laughing at the effort, but I hope he's also glad that I wrote the book.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Arnold Rampersad. His two-volume biography is called The Life of Langston Hughes. They're published by Oxford University Press. He's also a professor of English at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor Robert Prosky. He played Stan Jablonski, the roll call sergeant on Hill Street Blues. He's had a long career in theater, and last year was nominated for a Tony Award for his performance in A Walk in the Woods. He's currently appearing in the new David Mamet film, Things Change. I hope you can join us. Thank you.
sun's a satin. This is what I'm gonna sing. The sun's a satin. This is what I'm gonna sing. A field's of blues are coming. Wonder what the blues will bring.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the same way that Amnesty International fights torture, Article 19 fights censorship. Article 19 is a new group that draws its name from the section of the UN Universal Declaration of Rights that guarantees freedom of expression worldwide. Coming up, we speak with the executive director of Article 19, Kevin Boyle. Also, New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. is back in our weekly performance spot, this time paying tribute to songwriter Harold Arlen. And critic Ken Tucker comments on the most hyped video event of the year, the home video release of E.T. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. George Bush and Michael Dukakis agreed today to delay any victory or concession speeches until after the polls close on the West Coast next Tuesday. In 1980, President Carter conceded to Ronald Reagan just before 7 p.m. Pacific time, and many Democrats in the West believe this kept thousands of their voters away from the polls, costing the party one or two House seats and many local races. The Soviet Union today announced that it has temporarily postponed its troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. At the same time, officials said the Kremlin has increased weapons shipments to the Afghan government as fighting intensifies between the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul and Muslim rebels supplied by the United States. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
First Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Bezsmertnik told reporters here today that the Soviet Union still intends to meet a February 15th deadline for its troop withdrawal. But Bezsmertnik hedged his statement by warning that all parties to the Afghan conflict must abide by the terms of an agreement signed in Geneva last April. That agreement fixed the withdrawal deadline for the Soviet side. Half of the 100,000 Soviet troops stationed in Afghanistan were withdrawn by August 15th. The pullout was set to resume this month. Bezsmertnik today gave no indication of when the withdrawal might be restarted. Referring to the continued fighting in Afghanistan, he said conditions are not suitable for withdrawal right now. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Indian Navy ships today surrounded a boat filled with foreign mercenaries who fled the Maldives Islands with hostages after a failed coup attempt yesterday. The Indians are reportedly trying to negotiate for the hostages' release. The mercenaries are thought to be Tamils from nearby Sri Lanka. They fled early today after Indian paratroopers landed to help President Mamoon Gayoom and his lightly armed security forces. Gayoom, who has survived three coup attempts since he was elected president in 1978, said an investigation is underway to determine who was behind the latest attack. Islamic Jihad, the pro-Iranian group holding two of the nine American hostages in Lebanon, issued a statement today. It claims that Terry Anderson was not given a script for a videotape released on Monday in which he criticized the Reagan administration for not doing more to gain release of the hostages. Mike Theodulu has more on the story from Nicosia.
The statement reiterated past claims that hostages would not be freed because of the Gulf War ceasefire. It said they would be released only when the group's just demands were met, though it did not list these. It added that failure to free the hostages is a result of the American heresy, procrastination, and reneging on pledges and promises. It gave no details of these alleged promises. The statement also charged the Reagan administration of, as it put it, cheating, lying, and misleading the families of hostages. it claimed that all past hostage deals had been carried out by the U.S. administration, represented by the president, his vice president, staff and aides. Otherwise, the statement asked, who negotiated the TWA hijack and why were the 40 passengers and 735 prisoners in Israeli jails freed? The statement also asked the questions, who also negotiated in the Iran-Contra affair? Who gave it the weapons and took the money and funneled it to the Contras? For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
A draft Pentagon audit report says an Air Force logistics center in Georgia has paid top dollar for faulty spare parts. The report by the Office of the Pentagon Inspector General concludes that the military center paid an estimated $104 million for parts that did not meet contract specifications. The spare parts were said to amount to 89% of the center's inventory. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 24 points to close the week at 2145.8. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For the last few weeks, our performer in residence has been Harry Connick Jr., a young pianist and singer who grew up in New Orleans. Connick is now gaining a national reputation for his playing, which reveals a mix of blues, stride piano, and other influences from his New Orleans background. Today he's back with two more songs.
People often ask me who my favorite composer is, and pretty much without hesitation, I'll say Harold Arlen. Because he was just such a great composer, and he wasn't recognized for all the hits that he had. In fact, he was riding in a cab in New York, and the cab driver was whistling Stormy Weather, one of Harold Arlen's compositions. And Harold Arlen said, do you know who wrote that song? And the cabbie said, he says, no, I don't. And Harold Arlen said, well, I wrote it. And the cab driver said, who are you? And Harold said, I'm Harold Arlen. And the cab driver said, who? It just goes to show you that he wasn't the most popular of composers by name recognition, but he really wrote some tunes that everyone knows and loves. And here's one of his biggest hits of all time. I've Got the World on a String. Life is a wonderful thing if you've got the world on a string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let you go. I've got the world on a string.
sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. Oh, golly gee, I'm in love. Harold Arlen. Boy, what a tune that is. He wrote a million other tunes just as great. And right now I'd like to do another one of my favorites with a little bit of Louis Armstrong influence. As he once said, "What's the matter with you, boy? Don't you know I got a right to sing the blues? I've got a right to sing the blues. I've got a right to moan and sigh, right to sit and cry down around the river. A certain gal in this old town, she just keeps dragging my heart around. All I see for me is misery. I've got a right to sing the blues, right to feel low down. I've got a right to hang around, down around the river. When the deep blue sea, it just keeps calling me. Yes, it must be love. Say what you choose, I've got a right to sing the blues. It must be love. Say what you choose, I've got a right to sing.
Harry Connick Jr.'s second album, 20, has just been released on CBS Records. This is Fresh Air. Weeks ago, the British government issued a decree forbidding all media to broadcast or reprint statements by members of the Irish Republican Army or its political wing, Sinn Féin. This was the latest example of what Kevin Boyle sees as the worldwide threat to free speech and the free flow of information. Boyle is director of Article 19, an organization founded 2 years ago to monitor and protest censorship around the world. The group's name comes from the section of the 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights that applies to freedom of expression. Article 19 has just published its first world report on the state of free speech. Kevin Boyle told me more about the goals of the organization.
The function is to work for a censorship-free world based on the premise that every human being has the right to freedom of opinion and expression, and that that right is not a property of any particular political system, say the system of the United States, but rather is enshrined in the Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations of 1948. And the 19th article of the Declaration proclaims this right to freedom of opinion and expression, which is why we have called ourselves after the Declaration. So we are, if you like, a censorship watchdog and a body that wants to gain membership all over the world in support of the right of everyone to freedom of expression.
Would you read Article 19?
Yes, Article 19 of the Declaration proclaims everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers.
If governments don't like to acknowledge their own censorship, if they censor their own acts of censorship, how do you go about collecting accurate information?
You need ultimately to rely on people who live in the various countries in question or who are experts on them. And the book, this book we produced has been largely written from people from an inside point of view, short essays in each country from an inside point of view. And we are recruiting across the world correspondents, as we term them, people who will be prepared to brief us on developments on specific areas they're interested in or the general area of the media and academic freedom and so forth.
William Shawcross, the journalist, wrote the introduction for the book Article 19, and he makes an interesting point in that introduction. He says that for a lot of people, fighting censorship isn't as clear-cut as opposing torture. Everybody decries torture. Even the people who commit it won't admit to it. They'll decry it as well. But everybody seems to feel comfortable supporting restraints of one form or another when it comes to speech. Do you agree with that perception?
Yes, I think that it's a very astute perception and one that I have had to come to terms with. I think there are clear differences between systematic censorship, where you have an effort on behalf of governing authority to control all means of communication, to control the informational content of matchbox covers right up to encyclopedia and newspapers, and the persecution of people because they oppose the government and because their opinions are perceived as seditious and dangerous. That's one reality. In other countries, there are line-drawing issues and constant questions where freedom of expression is challenged. If we take the United States, where do you draw the line between explicitness and openness in dealing with matters, sexual matters, privacy matters, and the protection of public sensibilities, public morality, children, and so forth?
Let's talk about some specific countries that you're monitoring. Now, you're monitoring democracies as well as dictatorships. In France, the United States, and Britain, you say a big problem is the concentration of ownership of the media. Why is that an important issue in dealing with censorship?
It's an important issue because, not because, I mean, our organization takes a position or between private or versus public control of media as such, but that the effect of concentration in a few hands means that you are possibly and demonstrably in this country and in Britain drowning out alternative voices. You are making it more difficult for people to have access to the media, which after all is a medium, is an agency for the communication of information and ideas. It isn't the source of ideas, it's a vehicle. And the concern in the United States, and particularly on the electronic media, I mean, I'm saying nothing new, nor does the World Report say not much new to your listeners, that the new ownership of the three main networks, which is commercial ownership, not within the media business, creates the reality that news and current affairs on the television increasingly is treated as any other product.
The World Report for Article 19, the new organization, is dedicated to an editor of a South African publication called The New Nation, who's been detained without trial since December of 1986. Tell us a little bit about him and why you dedicated the book to him.
Swelaki Sisulu was elected to our board in November 1986, and within a month he had been detained without trial and has been in prison in South Africa for 2 years, as you say. He is the editor of a wonderful publication supported largely by the South African Bishops' Conference, a black paper in South Africa, a very interesting paper which has a major project which is concerned with the education of black people. He's in solitary confinement. He's married with two children. His wife meets him once a month. He has suffered from depression recently, which is hardly surprising.
Now, I believe he was a founding member of the board of directors of Article 19. It's interesting that he should be such... He's a symbol for you in two ways. He was part of your group, and now he's in prison. Has it been frustrating for you? You've been working these campaigns. Nothing has happened yet. This is an example of what you're going to be up against with your group, trying desperately to get somebody out to make change and finding your efforts, at least initially, not coming to anything.
Yes, I mean, in Zwelakhe Sisulu's case is particularly frustrating, knowing his family, his wife, and his children, and knowing that he is detained without trial or cause or justification. There, I mean, in any democratic society, there is a process involved if he allegedly did committed some offence, but that's not the route that's been adopted. He's simply been dumped in prison, out of the road, because they do not like the South Africa, the ideas and the proposals that he was promoting. They simply are trying to silence him. And effectively, that, as you say, is a symbol of what the role of censorship is. Censorship is really largely about control. It's an effort by governments or elites who have control, and often not without legitimacy, to maintain that control by ensuring that no rival ideas, that no criticism of their position, and often of their usurpation of power, is tolerated. And Zwelakhe Sisulu, therefore, is both a symbol of that form of repression, but also of the role of the journalist and the role of the media in highlighting and in protecting human rights. Where you get torture, you will very frequently get censorship, because censorship provides a wall of silence around which, or behind which, the security forces of the state can engage in the violations of human rights and ill treatment of people and detentions and disappearances without any public alert or public alarm. So there's an intimate link between the freedom of the press, the autonomy of the press, and the protection of all human rights, I believe.
Why did censorship become such an important issue in your life? Was there a turning point in your life where you had to directly face censorship?
No, I can't say that myself personally. I became involved in it because I realized when I was offered this opportunity to establish this new organization in London that freedom of expression is actually a touchstone of all other freedoms. I mean, everyone likes to say that the particular right they're concerned with, whether it's issues of the environment or freedom from torture, is the most important, or the right to life indeed. But I think, without getting into that debate, no society would be worth living in where one did not feel free to express one's views and to know what one reads, or you have choice in what you read, of what ideas are in circulation. That no society where everything is sanitized, where you are forced to praise the regime, where bad news, as it were, is filtered out, where only the one line is given. That is not a society which the vast majority of people in the world want anything to do with, though very many of them live under such regimes. So I think it's its fundamental character for all human rights that attracts me to the work to try to make it meaningful everywhere.
Kevin Boyle is director of the group Article 19, which is based in London. He edited the group's first world report, published by Times Books. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's happening at All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are coming up?
The Soviets are suspending troop withdrawals from Afghanistan, and the U.S. is disturbed but points out that the Soviet Union is still committed to pulling out there. Also, mercenaries have been captured in the failed coup attempt in the Maldives. And some interesting referenda are on the ballot around the country. In San Francisco, voters will vote yes or no on whether the U.S. battleship Missouri should be based there. In Florida, a proposal that the state inform the family of a crime victim whenever the person convicted of that crime comes up for a parole hearing. And then my favorite story of the day is giant tropical butterflies on a drunken spree in London and what they tell zoologists about their mating habits.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The largest grossing movie ever, E.T., is now available on home video. So is the Disney classic Cinderella. Critic Ken Tucker comments on their transformation for the small screen.
The big news in video, to adopt a reportorial tone all too rarely taken in this segment, is that 8.5 million copies of E.T. cassettes were delivered to video stores this past week. The 1982 Steven Spielberg film, so long and so cagily delayed in its cassette release, has created a 1988 media stir. So far, most of the discussion about this phenomenon has centered around stories of unavailability, advance orders left unfilled due to an unprecedented demand, resulting in angry and desperate moms and dads who felt they'd look ineffectual to their children if they didn't bring E.T. home on the night it first hit the stores. I think there's a certain amount of hype going on here. A few phone calls to some video stores where I live yielded the information that they've got stacks of E.T.s sitting around waiting for consumption. Amidst all this, there's been very little said about the movie itself. Does this grand fantasy, for example, transfer well to the small screen? The answer is no. E.T. was filmed as a widescreen theatrical extravaganza, and in fitting the movie into the squarer proportions of the TV screen, the image has been squashed in on either side. There's no doubt, however, that the power of Spielberg's storytelling probably triumphs over these aesthetic complaints. 6 years on, this story of a young boy's encounter with a friendly alien does have what many of its supporters said at the time of its first release: the look and emotional resonance of a children's classic. Another new release aimed primarily at children is Walt Disney's Cinderella. It's made the move to videocassette with considerably more success. This 1950 cartoon is one that any sensible adult must feel ambivalent about. On the one hand, this gorgeous production features some of the Disney Studios' finest, most accomplished animation. On the other, it presents one of Disney's most obtrusive rewritings of a classic fairy tale, stuffing the story with sentimentality and funny mice. Here, for example, are Cinderella and her rodent pals planning her dress for the prince's ball.
This one.
Oh, very nice. No.
You like it?
Oh, can do it.
It'll be wheezy.
I'll have to shorten the sleeves. I'll need a sash, a ruffle, and something for collar. And then I'll...
Cinderella. Oh, now what do they want?
Cinderella. Poor Cinderella. Every time she finds a minute, that's the time when they begin it. Cinderella. Cinderella.
Cinderella.
Whatever your opinion on those chattering mice, there's little doubt that most of the charm of this version of Cinderella carries over onto the TV screen. In one important area, in fact, it may even be a bit better than seeing it in a movie theater. In a theater, depending on who your local projectionist is, the animation's rich colors can often be drastically watered down to misty pastels. Videocassette quality control offers colors the way the animators intended them to appear. At a time when Saturday morning cartoons are dismally unimaginative, Cinderella is children's entertainment of a high artistic order. As it happens, there's a deluge of Disney on video right now. You can also get the studio's cartoon versions of Alice in Wonderland and The Sword in the Stone, but I wouldn't recommend them. They're sticky with sentiment and marred by bad music. Read the books to your kids instead. The underrated gem in the new batch of releases, however, is The Three Caballeros, the raucous 1944 cartoon in which Donald Duck meets up with the parrot Jose Carioca and Panchito, the Mexican rooster. It's got great south-of-the-border music, slapstick, and Donald's rude behavior.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with rock singer and guitarist Joan Jett. She's been playing rock and roll since she was 15, first with the all-girl band The Runaways, now with her own band, The Blackhearts. Joan Jett's latest album yielded the top 10 hit, I Hate Myself for Loving You. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from composer and saxophonist Julius Hempel. Hempel also plays with the World Saxophone Quartet and is the group's principal writer. And television critic David Bianculli previews the 7-part miniseries War and Remembrance. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.